I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, the second in a two-part exposé of a convicted Hollywood pedophile. In part one, we spoke to former child actor Nathan Forrest Winters, a survivor of child sexual abuse perpetrated by filmmaker Victor Salva, the writer and director of such features as the Jeepers Creepers franchise and the Disney movie Powder. In part two, we are joined by the young filmmaker Connor Fraser, who has taken it upon himself to tell Nathan's story in their new documentary, The Boy. In the following conversation, Connor tells us more about the documentary, as well as attempting to dissect Victor Salva and his films, which Connor and others believe give an insight into Salva's pathologies. Now, before we dive into the conversation, Connor has agreed to provide us with a Parallax Views exclusive, namely a brief clip of audio testimony from Nathan's fellow child co-star in Clown House, Brian McHugh. In this extremely brief clip, McHugh states that Salva set up a camera in the room where Brian would take his showers. After hearing that clip, we will transition with a musical track by Nathan Forrest Winters entitled The Monster, Part 2. With that being said, let's play that brief audio clip of Brian McHugh's testimony.
He made a film of me. I guess he left a the camera like on a laundry basket or something like that, so it just filmed my midsection as I got out of the shower.
Thank you.
Welcome to Parallax Views, Connor Fraser, director of The Boy, a documentary about Nathan Forrest Winters, who we just had on the podcast, and Victor Salva, the director of Jeepers Creepers 3, and also the previous two Jeepers Creepers, I should say. But that's the one that's on everyone's mind. I guess it's possibly getting a theatrical re-release.
Seems to be what everybody, you know, it's what's out there. I hadn't heard anything until today.
So, for my listeners that are unfamiliar, who sort of is Victor Salva, other than the Jeepers Creepers director, and how did you come in contact with this really disturbing story of his abuse of Nathan Forrest Winters when Nathan was a child working on the movie Clown House?
Well, Victor Salva, like you had said, he's a film director. He's directed a bunch of things outside of the Jeepers Creepers films. He did Rosewood Lane, Dark House, Powder, Nature of the Beast, and then I guess his, you know, most infamous would be Clown House, which was his first film. And that was released in the late 1980s, and it featured a young boy who was played by Nathan Forrest Winters. Winters and Salva had met through it was a mutual thing, because Nathan's mother knew a woman who had a daughter that went to a daycare that Victor was working at, and Victor had been saying that he couldn't find anybody to create a prop for this little short thing he was making. And so Nathan's mother, you know, took that on and made him a prop. And that's how he came in contact with Nathan's family, and then ultimately with Nathan. You know, after a little while of kind of getting to know one another, Victor would kind of, you know, he would go in and say things like, you know, you guys are swamped, let me take Nathan for the weekend. You know, we'll go to an amusement park, or we'll go to the movies or whatever.
Yeah, Nathan was telling us that he basically babysat him. And, I mean, Nathan also claims that he babysat other people, too, and that Salva worked in things like daycare.
Yeah, he worked in the daycare, yeah. And he babysat Nathan and other kids for, you know, a period of time, I guess, leading up to the Clown House, you know, fiasco.
Well, so since we covered a lot of Nathan's personal story with Victor in the interview with him, maybe you could tell me how you came in contact with the story of Nathan Forrest Winters and his testimony about Salva, because I got to be honest, you know, I knew about this way back when, like when, you know, Jeepers Creepers 2 came out, but it even seemed that back then a lot of people didn't know. Even some horror movie fans I knew didn't know about who Salva was. And I think in the past maybe 5 to 10 years, it's become much more well known. Whenever Salva releases a movie, there's a Daily Beast article or a BuzzFeed or a Vice piece about Salva's crimes. When did you first become aware of Victor Salva's crimes, though?
Yeah, the internet has done Victor no good in that respect. So I like a lot of people, I'm 22. So like a lot of people my age, we saw Jeepers Creepers as children. It was one of those horror movies, you know, because when you're a kid, the idea of seeing a horror movie is kind of dangerous, and there's a thrill to it because you're not supposed to watch them. So it was one of those series that, you know, most kids could watch. I mean, most, because it wasn't terribly bloody, gory, you know, it was kind of more like monster gore than real life gore. And so I think a lot of kids, you know, they're turned on to it from a young age, and some people have developed this, you know, nostalgia for them because of that. I never really did. I just kind of knew that they existed. But I would follow the film news sites because I like to, I was fascinated by the process of making films. So I would follow all of that, and you would see it pop up a lot, you know, people talking about, well, you know, is it time for us to forgive Victor, or, you know, whatever happened to Nathan Winters? I mean, a lot of people thought he was dead. People were saying that he had been paid into silence. So I just, I hunted him down. I found him on Facebook, and I just messaged him and said, let's make a movie.
What was Nathan's reaction to your wanting to do a movie? I mean, I know he said that he had other offers to do it, but he felt like you were the guy for the job. Was he reticent about doing anything at first or collaborating?
What had happened was that we spoke on Facebook, you know, through Messenger, and then it went to, we had a phone conversation, a good 2 hours, and we had maybe three of those, and that whole time it was kind of just feeling each other out. So there was a certain, I mean, I don't think he was necessarily reticent, but there was a certain kind of, you know, you had to fit a certain feeling. If he did not feel right, if you didn't feel right to him, you know, it wasn't going to happen. But yeah, he did have other offers, and a lot of them, you know, he could have made lots and lots of money off of them. But there was always there was always something else behind it, like, well, you know, you'll need to do this or that, or, you know, to kind of either amp up the story or to, you know, cut out certain pieces of it, or I know there was one incident where one of the companies behind Jeepers Creepers 3 had contacted Nathan and essentially said, look, if you don't go public and, you know, talk about this, let us do this film and let us just get it out there. We will set up a charitable organization in your name and proceeds will go to that. And Victor and Nathan said, I'm not going to do it, because ultimately when he asked them, is Victor going to have minors on the set, they wouldn't say yes or no. And he said, well, if you can't give me a straight answer for that, I'm not going to go along.
Do we have any evidence of Salvas still working with minors in any way? I know that's been a concern for a lot of people. Even going back to Powder, has it been a long time since he's officially worked with any minors on the sets of films?
The second Jeepers Creepers film, the beginning where the creeper kills the boy in the cornfield, the boy that he kills was 16 at the time of filming. But nobody, you know, I haven't been able to prove whether or not Victor had filmed that or if it was second unit. But I would imagine Victor would have filmed it because it was a core part of the film, but I don't know. Maybe a second unit team had shot that. But legally, he's not supposed to work with anybody under the age of 18.
Wasn't there problems when Jeepers Creepers 3 was being filmed in, I believe, Canada? I don't know if it was talent scouts or something happened with an agency they were working with on the film.
I think that was due to people just being wary of his past, because from what I could gather, Victor was not actively – I mean, the production was not actively pursuing any, you know, minors to be in the film. In fact, the call that they gave out was for a adult female that could pose as a 13-year-old. So, I mean, they were following the rules with that. I think his, you know, his history was a concern.
Well, getting back to your experiences with Nathan, you contact him through Facebook, you start talking. How does it start coming together, this documentary, The Boy? I think it's gone through multiple name changes. I was just on the Sectarian Review podcast, and when we recorded it, I had still thought the title was The Babysitter, or I think I had heard Pure Eternus was also a possible name. So maybe we could get that out of the way, how the name change happened, and also how you started actually working with Nathan on the documentary.
Well, the thing with that is that the movie is not really even a movie. I prefer to it more as a project than a film, because it there's so many different elements to it, and it doesn't follow the patterns of a typical film. There were no scripts. There was no real pre-production. It was literally me and Nathan in a hotel room filming things and coming up with stuff. So it was almost like, I think, as opposed to being a film, it was kind of just a, you know, visual form of art therapy. Because, you know, we never had, like I said, we never had a script, anything like that. We had a basic idea of where we wanted to go with it, you know, stylistically, but there was no set course, really. We were just seeing what we could come up with, because things like this, you know, this was 30 years ago. So for Nathan, he really had to go digging for all of these memories, because a lot of it had been suppressed in, you know, his mind. And when you're in a situation like that, you know, it's really hard to keep a consistent structure, because it is always changing, because it'll go from, you know, 1 second, and then you've got in the next second, you know, I just had this memory come back, or I just had that come back, you know. So yeah, like I said, it's more like a visual form of art therapy than a feature film, really.
And the name for listeners, it is called, as I said, The Boy. It's gone through some name changes, and I believe you guys are aiming for a release on October 31st, Halloween.
Yes, we're releasing it on Halloween. Yes.
So, how does this sort of filming at the hotel come about? Was that the first time you met Nathan in person, and how did that all come about?
Yeah, that was the first time we met in person. We had talked on the phone, and, you know, we had video messaged each other and everything else. But yeah, I mean, because honestly, neither one of us have much money at all. So it's not like we had this, you know, uber professional production. It was literally just us working shit out with the, you know, help of, you know, family members of his, and, you know, the donations from supporters. You know, a lot of people, you know, you make a film, and like, take like Blair Witch Project, for example. That was a movie that cost $60,000 to make. And that's considered low budget, like super low budget. What we did here, we did on a budget of only $3,000. Because that's what we received through, you know, donations. And I'm not knocking that. I mean, I think that was great. I have not, you know, that I wasn't really, I was just happy that people were donating, you know. And
when you say 3,000, you're including getting the hotel, eating, all that stuff in it. So, I mean, production cost wise, it's even less than that.
Yeah. When I say 3,000, I'm talking about, you know, that's all we had in general. And once you cut out, I mean, there was 2 weeks at a hotel, 2 weeks of, you know, food, and, you know, two plane trips for him. We really only had maybe $200 to play with when we were actually filming.
How did you overcome those budgetary restraints? Did you have a specific aesthetic idea to maybe approach that? I know people like, you know, horror's legend, John Carpenter, you know, he's really good at dealing with budgetary restraints. In fact, I would say his films on a low budget are better than his films on a big budget. So how did those budgetary restraints affect how you filmed the movie and what you were trying to go for aesthetically and stylistically?
Well, yeah, like I said, I mean, we had a, you know, a basic direction we were going stylistically, but, you know, with, you know, the nature of, you know, what we were doing, we didn't need a big budget, because what we were doing was very on the fly anyway. So it's kind of, you know, it was better for us not to be in a vacuum to where we could, you know, do anything at our disposal, because we were forced to think outside of the box, and it benefited, because that was the whole point, was that this is something that Nathan hasn't really dealt with you know, the feelings. I mean, he's lived with them, you know, his entire life, but he hasn't had to go back in time like that. And he hasn't had to go and really pick through the memories. And, you know, that was, like I said, it was a constantly evolving thing where, you know, one day, you know, he would be like, well, I can't think of anything. And then the next day he's like, okay, I've got it. And then you just have to pull out the camera and go. So because of that, because of the nature of, you know, the interviews, it really benefited creatively from that.
Would you say stylistically, I get the impression it's sort of an experimental documentary with sort of aesthetic elements borrowed from horror. I don't know if it's in color or black and white. Maybe you could give a few details on sort of the feeling and the vibe of the documentary.
It's a black and white film. It's pretty much everything in it is black and white. Stylistically, I guess, yeah, we didn't, you know, it's shot like it like some kind of piece of found footage almost, but it's not found footage in the sense of, like, you know, running around with the camera and breathing heavy. It's found footage in the sense of, like, these are almost like Nathan's memoirs, and they're just being recorded. And kind of the idea with it is that, you know, it's been 30 years and nobody has ever really had the opportunity to hear his side of it in great detail. So we're kind of, it's almost like having to dust off, you know, these old tapes and bring them into the light, because Victor has had, you know, 30 years of success. And I think now it's Nathan's turn.
So it's almost like a quote unquote lost tapes, style film.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that was the point that we had made in the press release last month when we announced that the film was coming out in Halloween. We talked about how, you know, when Victor was arrested, they found in his possession all of these tapes. And those tapes contained child porn, stuff that he had filmed of kids, including Nathan. And so he had, you know, his, you know, little secret stash of tapes, his little, you know, his dirty laundry, I guess you could say. And this was our version of that, is that this is a story that has kind of been painted over, and we're bringing it back.
Why do you think it has taken 30 years for anyone to approach Nathan and get this done? I mean, you've said other people approach Nathan, but it's taken a really long time to get a documentary about him out. And I find that surprising because, you know, this is, well, you know, Nathan said to me, it has that dark side of Hollywood appeal, which is huge right now, but it's been huge for years. And I'm surprised that this didn't happen earlier in a lot of ways. Why do you think it's taken so long for Nathan to get his side of the story out?
Well, because, I mean, I guess Nathan wanted to do it right. And if you're going to do it right, you have to bear all. And not a lot of people want to do that. A lot of people are scared to do that. They don't want to have to go into the details of you know, what actually went on. They just want this, you know, cut and dry picture of, you know, the Victor's the monster and Nathan's the innocent kid. They don't want the shades of gray that are in between. And we bear all of it. I mean, anything that he thought of, we filmed, and we didn't censor ourselves at all with that. And so maybe that's what frightens people.
Well, maybe you could elaborate on that. What do you mean by there's sort of shades of gray in how Nathan tells the story? I know Nathan has said that he's been very adamant that, you know, when we look at someone like Victor Salva, we have to remember that, you know, Victor was a young boy once too, that, no yeah. one starts out as a monster. Is that sort of what you're referring to a little bit? Is there anything else there?
Yeah. I mean, because the relationship, you know, with any form of abuse, the relationship is so much more complex than that. And I don't think it does either person justice when you just gloss over it and give each person a label. Everybody has their own you know, everybody's their own human being and they experience things, you know, in different ways. To just say, oh, Victor's a monster and, you know, Nathan was this little kid, you know, no, because, you know, on Nathan's side of it, if you do something like that, then Nathan ends up looking like some kind of like martyr. And he doesn't want to be considered a martyr or a victim or, you know, this little, you know, whatever. He doesn't want to be like this kid cowering in the corner. And on the other side of it, Victor Salvo, you know, they'll make him the monster with the, you know. And I mean, what he did was horrendous. But we and our production have never, we have never told anyone stop watching his movies. We have never told anybody that Victor is some piece of shit. We've never done that. We're just trying to tell the story as it happened. It's kind of like, you know, it is like just the facts, ma'am. You know, like that whole thing. That's what we're doing. We're like that cop in like Dragnet or whatever.
Now, is it just sort of Nathan's recollections? Is there any other interviews in the film? Anyone else you spoke to? I know Nathan said that Brian from Clown House, there may be audio from him in it.
Yeah, we interviewed, there was two other interviews that I had conducted. One of them was with Brian McHugh, who was Nathan's older brother in Clown House. He's the kid with the glasses. And then we'd also interviewed the film set designer, Bill Bacon. And, you know, Brian's interview, that was really the one that stood out. I mean, Bill Bacon was fascinating, but his recollections were, you know, very slim because it was so long ago. And I think that it was the same thing with Brian, too, and even with Nathan, where, you know, the difference was that with Nathan, I was able to sit there with him for 2 weeks while he tried to, you know, piece it together. With those guys, you know, you just have a short span of time to try to get an interview done. And if things don't come off the top of their head immediately, you know, you can't really go back. So, but Brian, you know, what he gave us, I think, was huge. And I think it's going to change the face of this thing. And that's the thing. I mean, people ask why make a movie about something everybody already knows about? Well, number one, they don't know the details. They don't know the context of it.
I'll go farther than that. I still know people that don't know that the director of Jeepers Creepers and all these other movies, that he's an abuser, that he's a convicted child sex offender. There's a lot of people that still don't know that.
Yeah. You're right. But, you know, a lot of the people that do know, you know, they just kind of shut us down and say, well, you're looking for money. And I mean, if we were looking for money, I don't know where it went because neither one of us has made a dime so far. You know, we don't get paid when we do interviews and we don't, you know, when we sit out here, we don't have a promotional department. You know, there's no marketing team. This is just us. Distributors, you know, we're scared of it, I think. I think they were, because we were being fucking honest. And that was so funny to me, because it's not as if this is a secret. You know, this is something that everyone knows happened, even if they're not sure of the details. 99% of the horror community especially knows, yeah, that guy was weird. So for people to be so like afraid of it, just I just makes me laugh. I don't understand what there is to be afraid of. But in the case of Brian, even then, I don't think it's necessarily something to be afraid of. But I think it's there's a new layer to the story. So that's why the film needed to be made.
And maybe you could talk a little bit about that second interview. What did you say his name was? Bill Bacon?
Bill Bacon, he was the set designer on Clown House, and he was a nice guy. I mean, we had a good 2-hour conversation, and he had been close to Victor. They were kind of friendly, kind of not, but they had a good working relationship. He had done the set design for Nathan. I mean, Victor's other film, something in the Basement, which Nathan was in.
That was the movie that basically was the reason Clown House got made, I believe. Coppola saw it and got the funding for Clown House Victor for that. Yeah.
Victor had shown it at a festival, and Francis Ford Coppola was one of the judges. And he was impressed by it, so he said, look, you know, I'll give you a little bit of money if you have a, you know, low-budget horror script you can produce. Because, you know, Francis Coppola came up with, like, the Roger Corman school, where, you know, you got your start in low-budget horror films that you made on the fly. So that's what he asked Victor to do, and that's how Clown House came to be.
So you said this, Bill Bacon, he was close to Victor. Did you get anything out of him, or... What was that experience like?
There wasn't a lot, you know, because they were not, I mean, they were collaborators, but I don't think they were the best friends. A lot of people, you know, like Nathan, his family, people that would have, you know, remembered, you know, that the production of Clown House and Something in the Basement remembered that they just were not very close personally, but they worked very well together creatively. So that was their dynamic. And when it comes to, you know, if you're asking, did Bill Bacon notice any red flags on the set? I think a lot of people did, because if it wasn't for, you know, there were people in the film, you know, when they're at the fair, there's that woman who, you know, she's the fortune teller. She was the one that kind of nudged it to Nathan's mother that there's something weird going on between Nathan and Victor. So without her, you know, maybe nothing would have happened, you know, because Nathan was very protective of Victor because Victor had manipulated him and coerced him. And he felt like he was his friend, so he was going to protect him. So, yeah, a lot of people realized that there was something odd with it. I mean, Nathan would sit on Victor's lap in the director's chair and give him kisses and all that.
That makes my skin crawl a little bit.
Well, there's even more out there, you know, in the film and, you know, out there in the public. If you search hard enough, the details of the crimes are just horrific, and the things that he did. Because he essentially made child pornography with Nathan and other boys.
Is that confirmed with the other boys, or is that more speculative?
Yes, when they raided his house, they found child pornography that included Nathan, but it was not just Nathan.
Okay, so did the court case, it didn't just involve Nathan then? Was he just sort of the most high profile?
Well, see, Nathan was the only one that came forward. That was the thing, is that... You know, and this will go back to Brian McHugh. Brian McHugh, and we're going to release it on this show. We have audio, and this is testimony from Brian McHugh, that Victor Salva had filmed him taking a shower. He had hidden the camera in a laundry basket. And so he got to see, you know, Brian get out of the shower, you know, presumably from the waist down, if he's hiding in the laundry basket to try to, you know, get that shot. And this is stuff that had come up in the court case, but that nothing ever materialized because McHugh's family, you know, they wanted to protect their son. So they really did not want to have the spectacle that was going to be, obviously.
Well, I was going to add to that. If there are other victims that haven't come forward, I've always suspected that, you know, it's in part because there is an even greater stigma around young boys and men who have been abused, because that's like the third reel for people. It's the third reel of the third reel when it comes to abuse. No one wants to fucking talk about it.
No, and that's something that we talk about in the film, because Nathan describes that he did struggle. You know, he said that he essentially became a little bit of a slut, you know, when he was a teenager. He was constantly sleeping with women just to prove to himself and to the world that he wasn't gay. And it wasn't about the fact that Victor was gay. It was just that Nathan was trying to form an identity outside of the one that, I guess, had been created when he was with Victor.
Well, I wanted to add that too, because, so when we look at, I think things like gay marriage have made, you know, homosexuality more acceptable now, and I think that's a good thing, right? But
yeah, and it's not, and that's another thing, that it's not about Victor being gay. It is right. Not about Victor being gay.
Well, what I wanted to add is, so in the past, before it was more acceptable, if you were, a teenaged boy, you may end up with an older man that was in the closet. Both the teenager and the older man would be in the closet, and things like that happened because you couldn't really be out in the open about being gay. But the thing is, Nathan was not a teenager. None of this was consensual. None of this was even close to it. I mean, this was going on since Nathan was 6 years old.
Yes, from the ages 6 until 11, it happened up until shortly after production wrapped on Clown House.
Well, the movie didn't even come out till 89, but I think it was done in 87?
It was 87 or 88. And then, you know, so they finished principal photography, and then Victor gets arrested. And then, after all of that breaks down, Nathan had to continue to go back to work because he had to do dubbing for the film. So you can tell in the film, you know, Nathan's mannerisms in the video footage, you know, in the film, is, you know, it does not match his vocal mannerisms, I guess, in the dubbing, because you can tell in the dubbing he was absolutely miserable and he just didn't want to be there. Whereas in the, you know, the film itself, the images, it seems like he was having a good time.
You talked about distribution. What sort of problems, if you can go into this, if you can't, that's fine. What problems did you have in regards to distribution and people that maybe were interested in the film and then got cold feet?
The two main factors were, you know, either they would want certain parts of it taken out, or they weren't happy with the way we shot it. And we kind of racked our brains for a little bit to find a way to take the footage that we had made, because we had no way to go back and do reshoots. We didn't. There was no chance of that. We had 2 weeks. That was our window. So we tried, you know, to kind of figure out what we could do with this footage to make it slightly more appealing for mass audiences. But then eventually it just kind of came down to, well, why should we? I mean, this is the film we wanted to make. So this is what we have. And like I said, it's not even a film. So I think that's probably, you know, one of the bigger difficulties outside of just the content was the fact that it's not a film in any real, you know, sense. It's an art project.
It's done in segments, correct?
We release it. Yeah, we're releasing it in segments because the idea is that these are fragments of kind of missing footage, and you have to, you know, put the pieces together. Because this is Nathan's story, that it's been 30 years since, you know, he hasn't really been able to tell it, or the situation was never right for him to tell it. So it's like this long overdue thing.
Well, the reason I asked about the distribution stuff, because I can hear listeners yelling as they're listening to this, they tried to shut it down. They tried to shut it down. And, you know, I can see this conspiratorial whispers starting, so to speak. I mean, as you said, I mean, there were people that thought Nathan was shut up and you know, was given a payoff to not talk anymore. So you have a lot of conspiracy theories, I think, that arise out of this case. Was there any attempt to sort of shut you guys up, so to speak?
No. And that's the thing, is that we've had a lot of people that have come in and out, you know, trying to offer help or whatever else. And some of them have been genuinely good people. And some of them have been people with their own ends who have tried to kind of ride on the coattails of what we were doing and would get very mad at us when we, you know, I guess you say called bullshit. And would, you know, we would, you know, say you got to go. And it's just funny to me because every single person, you know, in those situations, you know, they were acting so irrational. Victor was the only person who did not come at us with any kind of an attitude of, you know, shut it down. Or, you know, he didn't try to discredit us. He didn't do anything. And he knew the film was being made. We know that he knows.
You can confirm that?
I 99.9% sure I can confirm it, yeah.
Is there any reason you believe that he's aware of the film? Without going into great detail, necessarily.
Yeah, because my source is very close to Victor.
Okay, okay.
So he is aware. He is aware of, you know, where Victor is at with it, and he knows that Victor is aware of it. And all that we can really, you know, all that we can tell from that is that Victor is simply just doing what anybody would do, just preparing his lawyers in case we slander him, you know.
But you guys have never had any contact whatsoever with Victor in the process of this. I don't even think, I think since it all went down, you know, Victor Salva has never made an apology. He's never spoken to Nathan. I think Nathan maybe tried to write him at one point, but nothing ever came of it. Like, nothing, there is no contact at all.
Victor, Nathan had wrote a letter, and that I don't think he ever sent it, but he was like 12. And he wrote a letter to Victor while Victor was in jail or prison or wherever he was, because we don't even know. That's the whole thing with that, too, is, you know, Victor says, well, I paid my debt to society. Well, we don't even know. Was he in prison? Was he in a rehab facility? We don't know. You know, like that's never been clarified. And anyway, wherever he was located, Nathan had wrote him a letter. And he said, I am going to make sure for as long as I live that you will never touch another kid again. And that's true. I'm not, you know, making that up. That is something he wrote as a 12-year-old boy.
That's very, very intense. You know, it just boggles my mind that so he's still out there and about. I don't know if he's able to get movies made as much now after the absolute abomination and troubles that Jeepers Creepers 3 had.
And we sympathize with the fans that felt screwed over by the Jeepers Creepers 3 fiasco. We got, you know, kind of blamed for it a little bit when, you know, there was going to be that premiere and then it got shut down and everybody kind of immediately turns and looks at Nathan. And we put out a press release when that happened saying, you know, that we had absolutely nothing to do with that. We did not have any plans to interfere with that event. If people want to watch Victor Salva films, fine. But he's just not allowed to. Well, there's two factors.
Well, wait. Before you go on to the two factors, I want to add something here. I'm not sure how they could blame you because you know, there were outlets covering Jeepers Creepers 3. BuzzFeed was covering it. They interviewed the producer. And you know what? If they're going to blame you guys, they might as well blame BuzzFeed because I didn't see BuzzFeed even talking about the documentary there. They were just doing their own little news article. And they probably have far more reach.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but, you know, like we're talking about how, you know, the conspiracies kind of rage on that, you know, Nathan got silenced or something. But there's also the other side of it where they say that Nathan and his family suppressed the release of something in the basement because people say, well, whatever happened to that thing? And, oh, well, the family probably had it, you know, sealed or something or, you know, hidden away. But that's not even the case. We don't know what happened to something in the basement. I'm sure Victor still has a copy of it, but it's just never. And we were pretty close to finding a copy, but we were unable to. But we were very close.
Well, you mentioned there were two factors. I don't know if that maybe slipped your mind by now because I went off into a tangent. But
I'll just, you know, the motive behind the film, because like I was saying earlier, people, you know, were kind of suspicious and saying, you know, what is the gain here? What are you guys trying to get out of this? You know, this is a story that most people already know. And kind of the issues we have is, number one, Victor has never apologized. And number two, his films, even if he's not working with children, his films are littered with little, you know, bits and pieces of, I guess, his subconscious slipping in.
I think you're being too kind there. His films are essentially, and this is my view, it may not be your view, but Jeepers Creepers, that's taunting victims of abuse. That's what I see it as. I can't see it as anything else. And he's gotten progressively worse with it. Jeepers Creepers 3 is out in the open. It's in your face about what it's saying.
The third film, you know, they would have been able to get away with it had there not been that slip up with, you know, the release of, I think it was the first cut was released to critics, which contained a line which they ended up editing out of the, you know, mainstream release, in which the lead in the film, in the third film, is a girl this time around. And I think that might be, you know, Victor kind of noticing that, look, time's changing. I can't get away with this anymore. So I need a woman, not another young boy that, you know. But anyway, she has a little backstory where she was abused by her stepfather. And in the first cut of the film, there was going to be a moment, and this was written in the script. This is something that Victor Salvo wrote, where these boys were talking about, you know, how hot she was and saying, I mean, can you blame the stepdad? Just look at her. The heart wants what it wants. Am I right? So he makes a joke about how these kids cannot blame the stepdad for molesting her because she's just so beautiful.
Well, another aspect of this is I think Victor Salva has created this image for himself, and I don't think it's been very successful, but he sort of created this poor me image. I mean, when he made Nature of the Beast, he said it was based on his experiences in prison and how brutal people are in prison towards him.
And right, yeah, and Rites of Passage was about his experience coming out as gay. And then, Powder is just this, you know, and I'd like to put this out here because it really, I don't understand, you know, nobody has ever caught on to this. But Powder is a blatant ripoff of Edward Scissorhands, the Tim Burton film. A blatant ripoff. And it amazes me that nobody's caught on to that. Because it was made, you know, 4 years after Edward Scissorhands. And Edward Scissorhands was a pretty big, you know, it's one of the, like, the, you know, major Tim Burton films. You know, if you're going to watch a Tim Burton film, a lot of people say you got to watch Edward Scissorhands because it's his magnum opus, you know. So it was a big enough film, you know, that Victor, I'm sure, saw it.
Well, I guess the other thing with Salva is he'll often talk about how, you know, he was sort of an outcast, the chubby kid that would, you know, he would go to movies and everyone would be scared of the creature from Black Lagoon. But, you know, he identified with the creature because he was an outsider and I'm such an outsider.
Who does that sound like? It sounds like Tim Burton.
That's very true. Well, I'm wondering, do you think that image that Salva has created, and again, I know we're speculating, do you think that's necessarily as true as he makes it out to be, that he was like the sort of chubby outsider, no one liked kind of kid?
Well, see, there was a man that I talked to briefly who had went to high school with Victor. He called bullshit on that. He said Victor was a well-liked guy. And there, that image that he created was not real, you know, and I think that is my theory, and people can, you know, believe this or not, is that, you know, after the events of Clown House, having to kind of come out from this, you know, essentially being exiled from the world because, you know, he had been arrested and found guilty of, you know, pedophilia. I think he latched onto that aesthetic that Tim Burton was getting recognized for. That's my theory. I think in a lot of ways, not just with Powder, he blatantly ripped off Tim Burton just in a horror film sense, because Tim Burton has never really ever made a horror film. But that whole identifying with the creature and all that, that's Tim Burton. He was saying that in the 80s.
Well, I was going to say, one of the really chilling parts of Jeepers Creepers 2 is the whole beginning, where you have the creeper up as a scarecrow, basically. But he's in a cruciform. I'm like, yeah, what is Salva trying to say there? Yeah.
Maybe he fancies himself a James Whale type, because James Whale, you know, a lot of people talk about the, you know, Bride of Frankenstein from the 30s and maybe having allegories for kind of the homosexual outsider. And there's a scene in that film when the villagers are, you know, attacking and they string up Frankenstein onto this, you know, wooden setup that looks like a crucifix. So I'm wondering if, you know, if the majority of his career has just been stealing things from other people.
Almost like a low budget Tarantino.
Yeah. I mean, but with Tarantino, at least he knows how to write. I mean, you know. And that's, you know, and I don't want to sit here and shit on Victor, because I think Victor, I don't think everything he's ever done is terrible. And I don't want people to think that, you know, we are going to look down upon them for watching Victor Salva films. A film is a subjective thing. I like a lot of things that a lot of people don't. And vice, you know, other people have that, you know, they like things that I don't. whatever, you know, none of that bothers me. You know, I'm just kind of, you know, giving my own personal feelings here. I don't want anybody to think that this is how it needs to be, or this is like the official, you know, direction that we've gone with our production.
Well, I mean, listen, I don't think you need that disclaimer because Nature of the Beast is probably the Salva film that I think is his best. And, you know, I still think Salva's a horrible person, but I think it's a very interesting and well-done film. Jeepers Creepers, I think the first half is one of the best horror movies of the 2000s. It starts to turn into a little bit more of an action movie in the second half, but it is very well done for what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I love in the first Jeepers Creepers, I mean, when they go down into the caves or that, you know, that dungeon he's got under the ground and they have all the...
Oh, it's expertly done, yeah.
Oh, the set design is gorgeous, and they really, it was like a painting. I mean, it was absolutely gorgeous. So, you know, I'm not saying that Victor is just this total hack. I'm just saying that when it comes to his public image and certain things that he has tried to do to have himself perceived a certain way, I think he is taking cues from other more successful people, because he's hoping, I guess, the lightning will strike twice. And if it worked for people like Tim Burton, for example, it's going to work for him. The difference there is that Tim Burton is a genuine human being, and Victor Salva is kind of trying to concoct this narrative about himself.
Well, yeah, he's sort of the commercial filmmaker that wants to be seen as an auteur, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, going back, you know, we're talking about the opening of the second Jeepers Creepers with the crucifixion thing. That boy that he kills, you know, that blonde-haired little boy, if you compare that to what Nathan looked like when he was a child and what he looked like in Clown House, it's essentially as if he's killing Nathan. You know, it's like a you know, he's finally – my theory with it, you know, because this is all just, you know, I can't prove any of this. I'm just, you know, analyzing the films and kind of coming up with theories. But the success of Jeepers Creepers, I think, was so big that maybe Victor, to some extent, this was like his celebration. This was like his, you know, kind of fuck you to, you know, that part of his life. So he was able to symbolically kill that burden, that thing that was constantly in the way of his success.
That's how I feel about the ending of the first movie, actually, where he takes the Justin Long character at the end. You know, I'm like, yeah. That's such a, it's a fuck you, essentially, in my view. I mean, that's what it comes off as.
Yeah, and it's just, and all of his films are littered with some type of a fuck you. I mean, Rosewood Lane, nobody really remembers Rosewood Lane except
I wanted to ask you about Rosewood Lane, actually.
Except for the fact that Rose McGowan was in it, nobody really remembers that film. And the premise of that is that Rose McGowan is this woman who has this troubled history because her father was an abusive alcoholic. You know, it would sound familiar. I mean, we're going in circles, you know, with his stuff. And she's being antagonized by this paper boy, this like psychotic paper boy. And there's a scene in the film where the paper boy pisses all over the Rose McGowan's boyfriend, and he falls into an empty pool. And it's just this weird, like, it's so random and it's so out of place. And I question if there's symbolism in that.
How old was the guy who played the paper boy? I mean, was it supposed to be like a young paper boy?
Yeah, it's supposed to be like a 14-year-old, but the problem is that Victor cannot work with children. So this guy was like in his 20s, and it was evident.
It almost sounds like he's making horror movies that end up coming off like a bad porno.
That's what I said from the beginning, was that like the design, you know, of that paper boy, it just felt like it was like a bad porno. Like, you know, did somebody order the pepperoni? I mean, you know, the way he was dressed up, and it was this guy that was obviously not 14, you know, or 12 or whatever they were trying to make him. So that one, I think, that's one that I feel like doesn't really get enough exposure. Everybody kind of tries to go in and pick apart Jeepers Creepers and say, well, you know, Victor Salva is the real creeper, you know, or something. But they don't talk about Rosewood Lane. And I think Rosewood Lane was a very a very telling film. I mean, the poster for the film is a series of newspaper clippings, but a lot of them there, you can't tell what's on the clippings. It's just kind of, you know, it's unlegible. You can't read it. Except for one, and it's right near the guy's eye. It's just like this, it's like the half of a guy's face, and you got the eye there. It's like this evil glare in his eye. And right near his eye, you see in big black bold letters, top, the word top. And top is a slang term for homosexual, you know, when somebody is, I guess, you know, giving versus receiving in sex.
I'm curious, what is your take on Rose McGowan's involvement with that film? Because you know what, I will admit, I've been pretty supportive of Rose McGowan in the Me Too stuff, because she was talking about Me Too way before Aisha Argento and all the other ones did. I mean, she was blackballed, essentially. That's why she ended up in Victor Salva-type films. I mean, she was ending up in lower-budget stuff.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you know, it was a job. You know, I think with her, it was a job, and I tend to believe her when she says that she wasn't aware until, you know, it came up on the set, because they were filming in the suburb of Los Angeles in a real neighborhood. And they had, you know, there was people living in that neighborhood and, you know, surrounding the filming. And somebody had come out of their house and started shouting at the production, you know, because Victor, you know, he was not a fan of Victor. He knew who Victor was. And she said that that was when she realized, was when Victor started getting berated by a neighbor that was living on the street they were filming in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, she's a very interesting person, because, I mean, I was listening to her on Bret Easton Ellis's podcast. It was years ago now. But Bret Easton Ellis, of course, did American Psycho, and she was talking about all the Weinstein stuff before anyone else. This was before it really broke.
Yeah, even, you know, like Seth MacFarlane, you know, when he hosted the Oscars, there was a lot of jokes in there about Weinstein, and that was, you know, 2011.
Like I said, I think if you look over McGowan's filmography, as soon as she started speaking out, she was more or less blackballed into sort of direct-to-video fare and whatnot.
Yeah.
Was that also the case with Nathan? Because he hasn't been in a film since Clown House. Or did he just leave the film industry?
It was a combination. Because after he came out, the production company behind Clown House sued for breach of contract.
Coppola.
Well, I'm not going to say Francis Ford Coppola, because the issue with that is that Francis Coppola got everything together, and he, you know, the film was shot at his house and everything else, but the production company is not, it wasn't American Zoetrope. It was like Capitol Pictures or something. So I don't, potentially, but I'm not going to, and that's the thing, you know, a lot of people say, well, what do you think about this person and that person? I'm not going to go out here and say that Francis Ford Coppola is anything, because that's not fair, you know?
Okay, so I guess you take a different tact on that one than Nathan, because I know Nathan has been very critical of Coppola.
Yeah, Nathan is more critical, because I mean, because you gotta look at me, I'm the guy documenting it. I'm not the one that, you know, my feelings on it are going to be kind of an outside perspective. It's not going to be as deep as Nathan, and so we will differ on things. I mean, we differ on approaches, really. I mean, but the common goal has always been there, you know, even if we differ on approach.
Well, I was going to say, I really applaud you for that, because, I mean, with Coppola, there's all kinds of things that I've heard over the years, especially about the Philippines when he was filming Apocalypse Now, but it's so hard to prove any of that. So, you know, I appreciate you're taking a cautious approach to it.
Yeah, and we're supposed to live in a society where you're innocent until you're proven guilty. I mean, I know the court of public opinion doesn't really see it that way, but I don't, you know, feed into the court of public opinion, and Nathan knows that, and there's respect there. I mean, I respect his opinion, and he respects mine. I mean, we just differ on the approach, really. It's not even the common, the message is still the same. we align on the message, and that's what's important.
Do you think, in regards to Coppola, before we move on from that, do you at the least think he's been very, shall we say, supportive of Salva? I know American Zoetrope, of course, were the ones behind the Jeepers Creepers franchise, and I've heard that Salva was told by Francis Ford Coppola when the whole jail thing was happening, well, it'll make you a better artist. You'll get through it, Victor. But I can't judge because I don't know what their relationship is like, and I don't know how Coppola feels about it all.
Yeah, because that's something that Victor had said in an interview he was doing when he was promoting Peaceful Warrior back in 2006. The article, I think, was in the LA Times, and it's called Victor Salva's Horror Stories, which I love that title. And that's one person, that's his, claim as to what happened. Francis Coppola has never really, said anything about that. It's a working relationship as far as anybody can tell. And that's nothing, whatever. I mean, there isn't any reason for me to go out here and wave a flag and, demand that we all go down to his vineyard, because that's not fair. It's not fair.
So in that regard, Salva has worked with a number of actually really talented actors, talented people.
Can I also say, in terms of Francis Coppola, that there was an incident on the set of the film where Francis had Nathan did not have to be on set for maybe an hour.
This is Clown House we're talking about, right?
Yeah, Clown House. Clown House was filmed. The house that they all live in was Coppola's, that it stood in for, the house in the film. So Francis was present to some extent. I'm sure he let the production do its own thing, but he, took Nathan to his bungalow and showed him, he just kind of showed him around, like, this is what it's like to make movies, because he was young and it was his first film. And Victor just comes in steaming pissed, demanding that Nathan needs to be on the set. And it was this awkward thing. Nathan said it was this awkward experience because Victor was totally taken aback by it. And it was like a jealous lover. So,
Victor was taken aback or Coppola?
Coppola was taken aback.
Okay, you said Victor initially. Yeah.
No, yeah. Victor had come in there, steaming pissed, just, demanding that Nathan come back to the set, even though he wasn't needed. And
Coppola was like, what is going on here? Right.
Francis Coppola was like, what the hell is this? So, that's some more context from that end, because I know a lot of people speculate, and, Nathan has his speculations, and, everybody is entitled to their opinion. But from an outside perspective, you got to look at the facts of the case. And the facts, as they are now, is that it really – it even kind of shocked Francis a bit as to how weird he was with Nathan on the set.
That leads me into – we've talked about Coppola. But as I said, Victor Salva has actually worked with a lot of talented, talented people, especially actors and actresses. I mean, Meg Foster was just in Jeepers Creepers 3. Lance Henriksen has worked with him. I think he was going to work with him on Jeepers Creepers, but that ended up not happening. They worked on Nature of the Beast, also with Eric Roberts. Worked with Ray Wise now. Jonathan Breck, who plays the Creeper. Have any of these people commented on the whole Victor Salva scandal?
Not really, no. I mean, that's the other thing, we're talking about, public perception, and, I very much try to avoid the witch hunt, and Nathan does too. I mean, we consciously from the get-go avoided creating this witch hunt because it's not fair. I mean, if Jonathan Breck can look past Victor's history and, say that this is a guy that just wants to make films, and I'm more than happy to do that with him, that's fine. It's just when people try to take the severity of what he did and kind of diminish it, that's when we're alarmed. So the majority of the people he's worked with has not ever really tried to diminish. There's only been one.
Who was that, out of curiosity, if you could speak to it?
That would be Lin Shaye.
Oh, really? from New Line Cinema. She was in Detroit Rock City. I think she's married to Robert Shea, who runs New Line.
No, Bob Shea is her brother.
Brother, okay, yeah. And she was in Nightmare on Elm Street, Detroit Rock City, all that stuff.
New Nightmare, the Insidious films, and she was also in Rosewood Lane.
Okay, I did not know she was in Rosewood Lane. What was her, what did she have to say about Salva?
There are people that we interact with, you know, supporters and people like that, who, you know, they'll be very vocal about the issue online. You know, they'll talk about it. And one of these people who was a supporter of ours had made this post about Victor, and he was friends with Lynn Shea on Facebook, because Lynn Shea just kind of lets everybody add her. It's kind of like, you know, interacting with your fans and all that. And she, for some reason or another, decided to comment on it, even though they were total strangers, that he was only friends with her on Facebook simply because he was a fan. They were not friends. And in all caps, she writes, "Time to move on." So she believes it's time for everyone to move on from this. And I would not be so mad about that statement if it wasn't for the fact that Victor has done nothing to try to repair it. He's done nothing. He cowers behind this statement that he gives every time there's a fucking, you know, there's hoopla. He says, well, you know, I paid my debt to society and all that. But he never says, you know, I'm sorry and that what I did was fucking horrendous. He never did that. Not once.
Well, I was going to say that it's interesting she would say that, because I know Rose McGowan has gotten a lot of flack, but all Rose McGowan really said was she found Victor, just on her communicatory level with him, to be very kind and caring towards her.
Yeah.
And he was complex, and she was commenting on her personal experience with him.
That's right.
She wasn't defending him, though.
I think complex is the best way to describe it. I don't think Nathan would disagree with that. Nathan does not go out here and say, oh, well, Victor's just this piece of shit. Nathan will totally agree that he's a complex person and that it's not about hanging him, you know, in town square or something. It's about simply the content in his films, which leads people to wonder, you know, especially with, you know, that's something we're trying to bring up in the, with, you know, our stuff is, you know, it needs to start leading people to wonder, you know, how much of this is, you know, conscious, you know, Victor is writing these things consciously as a fuck you. And because that would show that the whole reformed man thing is crap. If he's sitting here and shooting little, you know, shots at Nathan and, you know, the societal attitudes towards pedophilia in his films. And then also just the fact that he didn't apologize. Anybody close to that, close to Nathan, his family, whatever, will tell you that they do not care if Victor makes horror movies. But how dare he make a movie like Powder through the Walt Disney Company.
I guess before we wrap up on this, what do you think is going to happen with well, before that, I want to say this. With regards to Lynn Shea and maybe some of these other actors, I don't want to completely shit on Lynn Shea, because, I mean, my take is that, like, and maybe you'll agree or disagree, I get the feeling that it's not so much there's this conspiratorial plot to
no.
cover up Victor Salva's crimes, because I think everyone knows about it. What I think is going on for a lot of people in Hollywood that have worked for him is, I think a lot of people are really embarrassed and they just don't want to talk about it. They don't want to hear about
yeah,
it anymore
exactly.
because it's really embarrassing to people in Hollywood that have dealt with him.
And it is. It's a difficult thing because, you know, you're trying to do this and there's a lot on the line because you've invested money into this film. I mean, I totally get that. And when it comes to Lynn Shea in particular, I'm not telling anybody, you know, hey, fuck her. No, what I'm saying is probably, you know, what would a better way to describe it would be, I want to know why she said it. I don't, I'm not trying to condemn her. I just want to know why.
Well, I think that's fair enough. I guess in closing, in regards to Victor Salva, Nathan Forrest Winters, and your documentary, The Boy, how can my listeners support the film, get the word out there? Anything you want to do to sort of promote the film, just go out there right now and put it out there for my listeners.
We have a Facebook page, facebook.com/NathanWintersFilm. We also have an email. I believe, yeah, it's my production company, which is listed on the website. So if you go to – I'm not the website, the Facebook page. If you go to the Facebook page, you know, send us a message. If you're interested in pre-ordering the film, whatever, we will direct you to where you need to go. We've already got a few pre-orders, but we will be releasing it completely on our own through, you know, a variety of platforms. You know, there's going to be physical copies, digital. We're going to have, if anybody wants to purchase the film's poster, if they want to purchase the soundtrack, we will have that, because Nathan himself composed the soundtrack. I forgot to say that, and I don't know how I could have forgotten, because it's such a core element. Nathan composed the score to his film. So, yeah, go on Facebook, and, you know, we will have the email listed on there to where you can go and, you know, just say, hey, I want to pre-order it. You don't have to give us any money, right? You know, if you, when once the film is released, then you will pay for it. We're not going to make you pre-order and have to pay. We're just going to put your name on a list that we've got of people so that we know how many to make initially.
And you guys are also on Twitter as well, right?
Yeah, we're on Twitter as well. I know Nathan is. I cannot remember his Twitter handle for the life of me. I'm on Facebook. I mean, you'll be able to find me pretty easily because I have a very unique, you know, my first name has a very unique spelling. So, yeah, I mean, that's really what we're doing with this is we're going to set up a shop online, and all of the money goes back to us. You know, if you buy the film, if you buy the soundtrack, whatever, it goes back to us. And Nathan has long been developing a sort of grassroots awareness organization called We Are Their Voice. And some of the proceeds from the film will go to that, go to developing that and getting it off the ground.
What do you think the effect of the film will be? And also, I just wanted to get your comments. How do you feel about this documentary coming out? You know, basically, you guys have perfect timing on it because, you know, since July and since recent developments, the Epstein case has been blown wide open. And, you know, I feel like before there was Jeffrey Epstein, there was Victor Salva.
Yep, absolutely. Before Epstein, there was Salva. And, you know, I think things just really worked themselves out in the end. I mean, the distribution thing, you know, we had such a hard time with that. We eventually just kind of came down to this point where it's like, you know, we have been so interactive with supporters that why don't we do the same with the distribution? Why should we funnel it through a company when, you know, we can go straight to the people that are going to want to see it? Because those people have been with us the entire time. And they'll be able to, you know, if they're worried about where their investment is going with the film, it's going back to the people that created it. You know, it's not going to some company that is trying to capitalize on his abuse, or some company that is going to want to, you know, minimize certain aspects of it, you know, because they're afraid of offending someone or whatever. It's going right back to us, and it's going to Nathan's grassroots campaign. So we're going to have a shop, and we're going to have it listed on our Facebook page once it's up. And we'll probably have it up this month sometime. And like I said, you can my email, the production's email, is listed on the Facebook page, so you can contact us, reserve a copy of the film, or if you want a copy of the soundtrack, which we'll be putting on vinyl, You can have that, you know, there's, you can, if you want the film's poster, whatever. And it, we're, it's going to be, if you buy the film, you're going to get more than you bargained for. Let's just say that. I mean, it's not going to be just, you know, a fucking disc, you know, that you spent however much on, you know, it's going to, you're going to get your money's worth, because we really took great care in how we decided to put it out there. So it, you were asking also about what I think the impact will be. I really don't know. I don't. I mean, I think, you know, even people that say, you know, I've really wanted to see this, you know, even if you're asking for it, I don't know if you're totally prepared for it. So that's my, I don't know. All I have to say is that I don't think there's any way to be prepared for what you're going to hear and what you're going to see. And that's even held true for us. You know, I mean, Nathan, you know, this is his about him, but it still surprises him, you know, certain aspects of it, you know, especially the Brian McHugh thing. That was huge. That was, this is gigantic. And I feel like people really need to get that out there. They need to be made aware that Victor has done this before, that this is not just Nathan.
Well, in that regard, I'm very looking forward to this film. Again, listeners, it'll be out October 31st. And real quick, are you guys going to be dropping a trailer for it? I know there was talk of that. And when that trailer drops, I'm hoping there will be a mass retweeting campaign of that trailer to promote the film.
We'll be releasing a trailer, should be later this month. We have one made. So we're just kind of, you know, trying to figure out, you know, when we should do, when would be the best time to do it. You know, that's, you know, there's politics to all of it, you know.
Well, hey, Connor Fraser, director of The Boy, out October 31st. I want to thank you again for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views and our two-part expose of convicted Hollywood pedophile Victor Salva. Be sure to look out for Nathan and Connor's documentary, The Boy, which should be out on October 31st. I'm going to once again refrain from my usual support me on Patreon spiel and instead close the show out with Nathan Forrest Winter's musical track, The Boy. Thank you.
and boys.